He says that one who gives food gives five things. He gives life, his long life. He gives beauty or good complexion. He gives happiness. He gives strength, physical health, and he gives intelligence. He goes, the person who receives the food and who eats it, then he gets, his life gets extended, he acquires a good complexion, he feels happy, pleasure over receiving the food, he gains health, and his mind is able to function properly and to utilize its intelligence. And the Buddha says that one who gives food gives these five things, and in turn he receives these five things back. That is, the karmic result of giving food is to obtain for oneself long life, if not in this lifetime, then in some other lifetime. You obtain yourself beauty, happiness, health, and intelligence. All of this comes through giving. Then, on many occasions, the Buddha has given practical bits of advice to lay people on how to deal with their economic affairs. One time, a group of lay people came to the Buddha and said, Bhante, we aren't monks living in the forest. We don't know much about meditation or philosophy, but we need something that's practical, something that can help us right here and now, and also something that will help us advance in future lives. Teach us what is appropriate for us. Then the Buddha taught them four things that lead to happiness here and now. He said, first, the first thing that's required is energy and diligence. If you work at some job, some profession, trade or business, you have to be energetic and diligent in performing your work. The second factor is security. It is when you acquire wealth, you have to protect it carefully to make sure it remains safe. The third thing is good friendship. You have to associate with good friends, true friends, with virtuous people who will help you and protect you. Then fourthly, you have to maintain a balanced livelihood. You shouldn't be too bountiful, spending more than your means permit, and you shouldn't be niggardly, clinging to your wealth. But you should avoid these extremes and spend in proportion to your income. Those are the four things the Buddha taught leading to welfare here and now. Then he went on to teach four things that lead to long-term benefit in the future. That is faith or confidence and spiritual values, generosity, moral discipline, and wisdom. The Buddha also got down into the very practical matters of the right ways of acquiring wealth, the four standards of right livelihood to which the lay follower should conform. That is, he should acquire wealth only by legal means, not by illegal means. He should acquire it without violence. He should acquire it honestly. And he should acquire wealth in ways which do not harm others. Then, having acquired wealth in these ways, the Buddha went on to teach five uses that the lay person should make of his wealth. Firstly, he should use it to provide for his own household, his family, relatives, children, and so on. Secondly, he should use the wealth to make gifts to friends, to entertain them, to give them presents at the holiday seasons, and so on. Thirdly, he should use wealth to protect and repair his property and his dwelling. Fourth, he should pay taxes and make the oblations to the deities. And fifth, he should use wealth to offer alms and requisites to the monks and Brahmins. This deals with some of the aspects of the Buddha's economic teaching. Now, coming to the specific social teachings of the Buddha, the teachings that are designed for molding and transforming society. Now, from the Buddhist viewpoint, society itself is an obstruction, not a reality. Society is a collective whole made up of individuals, and the quality of society reflects the individuals who compose it. If the individuals are corrupt, the society will be corrupt. If the individuals are noble and pure, the society will be noble and pure. Since society merely reflects the individual, its individual members, the Buddha aimed at transforming society by giving individuals new standards of conduct, new ideals and patterns of behavior which would elevate and transform their conduct. Then changes in the social order would follow as a matter of course. There are various codes of conduct taught by the Buddha which fulfill this requirement. These codes were designed originally for individual observance, but when put into practice, they bring about far-reaching changes in the social order. Some instances we might mention are the five precepts: to abstain from killing, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from intoxication. Though these lines of conduct help improve our individual conduct, but when they're observed by many people throughout the society, then they purify and elevate the society. Similar considerations apply to the 10 courses of wholesome action, 10 bases of merit, the Noble Eightfold Path, and so forth. Now, the unit of society upon which the Buddha places the greatest emphasis is the family. The Buddha regards the family as especially important because the family is the intermediary between the individual and society as a whole. It is in the family that the individual receives his basic training. It is here that he learns the ideals and standards that will govern his conduct for the rest of his life. And therefore, sound relationships have to be established between the members of the family in order for those who are raised in that family to become responsible members of society. The Buddha deals with family relations generally under two headings: the relation of husband and wife and the relation of parents and children. Regarding the first, he holds that the husband and wife have certain reciprocal duties which they should perform. These are given on the supplementary sheet for this lecture. It's one of the mutual duties of the different relations in society. So these can be obtained by consulting that sheet. They don't have to be mentioned here. The Buddha, however, it should be said, emphasizes that marriage is not only a means to economic security, to companionship, or to sensual gratification. While all of these might enter into the marriage relationship, they do not exhaust it. Ideally, the relationship of marriage should promote the moral and spiritual development of both husband and wife. Therefore, the husband and wife, while performing their respective duties to each other, they should be generous towards others. They should observe the precepts avoiding wrong actions. They should support religious teachers, the monks, the sangha, and also they should cultivate their own spiritual practice. Then with regard to the relation of parents and children, the Buddha emphasizes the reciprocal obligations of both. The parents have the duty to educate their children, to bring them up properly, to steer them away from wrong, to guide them towards what's right. These duties are set out on the sheet. The children also have duties to their parents, to respect their parents and to attend to their needs. And speaking to the monks, the Buddha stresses the filial obligations of the children. He says there are two people that you can never repay, your mother and your father. The reason is that your mother and father give birth to you, nourish you, bring you up, support you. They teach you, educate you, introduce you to the world. Therefore, you can never repay them, even if you carry them on your shoulders for the rest of their life. However, the Buddha says, there is a way to repay mother and father. That is, if they don't have faith in the Dhamma to establish them in faith, if they don't observe the precepts to teach them the precepts, if they're stingy and selfish to teach them to be generous, if they're deluded and lack wisdom, then you should give them teaching on how to develop their wisdom. In this way, the Buddha says, you can repay your parents and do more than repay your parents. In coming to society at large, we find that the Buddha set out the basic social relationships in terms of different classes of people, and he said that the members of these classes have certain duties or obligations to each other. For example, in society, we have friends, and so each person has a relationship or certain duties to his friends. We work at a job, and so we have duties to our boss if we're an employee. Or if we are an employer, then we have certain duties to our employees. The teacher has duties to his pupils. The pupils have duties to their teachers. The lay people have duties to the monks, to the Sangha, and the monks have duties to the lay people. Now, this last group is something that I'll deal with a little bit at some length. That is the relation of monks and householders in a Buddhist society. The Buddhist monk, the bhikkhu, is not a priest who has some intermediary role between the laity and some higher spiritual being, a god or a deity. The monk is somebody who has left the household life in order to practice very diligently the teaching of the Buddha and to help sustain the teaching, to keep it alive in the world. And the Buddhist community as a whole divides into these two sections, the Sangha and the laity, the monastic order and the householders. And the Buddha teaches that these two have to cooperate, to work hand in hand to preserve and to propagate the Dhamma, to make the truth, the liberating truth, available in the world. And the Buddha holds that each side in this pair has certain obligations towards the other. The laity, he teaches, should provide for the material needs of the Sangha. The monks do not work at some secular occupation, earning money and buying things that they need with their money, but they live in dependence on others for their material requisites. Parapatipanta me jivikati. My livelihood is dependent on others. That's a reflection of the monk. So the livelihood of the monk is dependent upon the gifts and donations of others. And since the order requires the support of the laity, the lay people, the householders, are advised to provide for the material needs of the monks, to show them respect and to encourage them in their efforts to practice and teach the Dhamma. The monks, in turn, who acquire the knowledge and experience of Dhamma, have their duty to the laity. On the basis of their knowledge and experience, they're advised to teach the lay people, to make the Dhamma known to them, to give them guidance and advice, which will help them practice the Dhamma in their day-to-day life. And also the monks have the duty to give the lay people opportunities for more intensive practice, as in undertaking meditation retreats and so forth. The Buddha says that these two divisions of the Buddhist community, the monks and the laity, should help each other and assist each other, so that in this way both will be able to cross the flood of samsara and reach the safe shore of Nibbana. Now we come to the political teachings of the Buddha. According to the traditional account, the Buddha was originally himself destined to be a king. He was the son of a king, destined to become a king, but he renounced his right to the throne in order to become a religious seeker. Historically, as a member of the class of the Kshatriyas, the nobles, the aristocrats, before his renunciation, he must have gained extensive experience in government administration. And even though he became a religious teacher rather than a ruler, still, he frequently came into contact with kings and with government officials of the various states in which he moved and taught. His disciples include a number of kings. King Bimbisara of Magadha, who was one of the most powerful kings of the time. King Pasenadi Kosala, another powerful king, the king of the state of Kosala. King Ajatasattu of Magadha. These were disciples of the Buddha. King Udaina and others. Also, at the time of the Buddha, there were a number of republican states in northern India in which the Buddha taught. And the Buddha also gave advice and counsel to their leaders, especially the Lichavis, who lived in the area of Vaisali. So the Buddha had disciples from both types of political rule, the republican and the monarchical. And the Buddha gave teachings impartially to their leaders, their representatives, and their citizens. However, the Buddha didn't advocate one type of government over another. He didn't prefer republican government to kingship, and he didn't prefer kingship to republican form. But rather, he taught that whatever the form of government might be, the guiding principle of the state should be the Dhamma, the law of righteousness. The sovereign body in the state does not have the right to use its power for its own advantage. And the reason it doesn't have this right is because it is subject to a higher law, a higher rule, a law independent of all arbitrary whims, desires, and fancies. That is, it is subject to the cosmic law, the ethical law of Dhamma. One time, this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, a monk comes to the Buddha and says, "Bhante, the ruler, the king, the Chakravarti Raja, the wheel-turning king, has great power. He's the sovereign of the land. But tell me, is there a ruler of the king? Does the king have another king above him?" And the Buddha says, "Monk, yes. The king also has his ruler. The king has another king above him. And what is the ruler of the king? The ruler of the king is the Dhamma. The king," the Buddha says, "should respect, revere, and venerate the Dhamma. He should take the Dhamma as a standard, the Dhamma as his criterion, and he should rule his kingdom in subordination to the Dhamma. And thus the Dhamma, this moral, spiritual principle of righteousness, this becomes the governing standard of all the particular forms of government, the standard against which we can measure all the particular laws passed by a state, all the lines of conduct undertaken by a ruler, by the ruler. And to rule in accordance with the Dhamma, the government must provide for the material welfare of its citizens, and it must also establish conditions which will promote their moral and spiritual development. The Buddha does not stop with mere generalities. He goes on to lay down specific ways for the king or the ruling power to substantiate the Dhamma in its administration. One formula he gives on the negative side is the avoidance of the four evil motives. In the texts themselves, these are given for the king, but they can be applied to any ruling official. The four evil motives that are to be avoided are firstly partiality or favoritism, showing attachment to certain people or ideas. The second is anger or hatred, that is intense aversion towards people or towards other things. The third evil motive is delusion, to be confused, stupid, and dull-minded. And the fourth evil motive is fear, to act out of fear and timidity. On the positive side, Buddhism teaches that the government, especially the king, should observe 10 standards, which are called the 10 royal virtues, the Dasa Raja Dhamma. These are often referred to in the Jataka tales, the stories of the Buddha's past lives. First of all, the king should be generous. Should be ready to distribute the wealth of the kingdom to the people, to make sure that everybody is able to acquire the basic necessities of life, that nobody has to be hungry or be deprived of a dwelling place, clothing, and so on. Secondly, the king or the rulers should be well disciplined in his conduct. He should observe the 5 precepts. Not to kill, steal, commit adultery, lie, or drink intoxicants. Third is the virtue of self-sacrifice. The ruler should be ready to sacrifice himself for the good of the kingdom, ready to give up everything for the benefit of his subjects, even his own life. And the Jataka stories give us an interesting illustration of this virtue. In one story, we meet a monkey king. This is the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha. This monkey king has to look after the welfare of his troop of monkeys, take care of them and rule them. And once, when they were in danger, they have to flee through the forest. They have to pass over a number of trees, but they reach a certain point where there's a gap or a gulf between one tree and another. And so the monkey king lays down on one tree. He grasps the tree with his feet. Then he leans over and he grasps the tree on the other side with his arms, with his hands. And he makes a bridge out of his body so that all the monkeys could cross over to safety. But as a result of this brave act on his part, his back gets broken. And at the time that this is happening, there is a human king down below passing through the forest, and he watches this event. He witnesses the great, noble, courageous act of the monkey king. And when he sees that the Monkey King has been ready to give up his life for the safety of his fellow monkeys, when the Monkey King falls out of the trees, falls down to the ground, the Human King comes over to him and asks him why he did this. And then this Monkey King, with all of the grace that will become to manifestation in his later achievement of Buddhahood, the Monkey King teaches the Human King that it is the duty of a ruler to be ready to sacrifice even his own life for the welfare of his subjects. And thus, a Human King learns the proper duty of a ruler from a Monkey King. The fourth royal virtue is justice. The king should administer his realm with justice, with equality towards others, not with favoritism and partiality. The fifth virtue is gentleness. The king should be gentle, loving, and kind to all the people. Sixth is austerity. The king should be austere in his own way of life. He shouldn't be addicted to luxurious enjoyments, to comforts and conveniences, but he should try to live very simply, contented with the basic necessities. Seventh, he should be free from enmity, from hatred and ill will. Eighth, he should rule with non-violence. He shouldn't be fond of conquering by war and by violence, and he shouldn't be disposed to inflict violent punishment on others. The ninth virtue is patience, not getting angry and upset, remaining persistent despite difficulties. And the tenth virtue is non-opposition. That is, the king should not oppose the will of the people, but he should always follow their will when it accords with what is right. Those are the 10 royal duties of the ruler. The Buddha also gives in the suttas, he mentions four, what are called the four bases of popularity. These are already contained in the, at least implicitly, in the 10 royal duties, but we'll just mention them for the sake of completeness. The four bases of popularity are generosity, kind speech, benevolent conduct, and impartial treatment of others. Beyond these, the Buddhist text also mentions some uncodified obligations of the king or government that the ruler should implement in his rule. The government has the duty, firstly, to protect all the inhabitants in the land. And the texts say not only the human beings, but the animals as well. This is very significant that the Buddha teaches that the righteous king protects not only people in all the different social classes, but he also has the obligation to protect the birds and beasts, the animals of the land. And in accordance with this precept, we find that in Buddhist countries such as Sri Lanka and ancient India, perhaps Burma and Thailand also, the great Buddhist kings of the past have built animal hospitals and have had doctors trained to take care of the animals. The government or the king also has the noble duty to inspire the people in virtue. The king is compared to the leader of a herd of cattle. The people are like the cattle who follow the leader. If the chief bull in the herd takes a wrong course, then the other cows will take a wrong course. If the chief bull goes the right way, the other cows will go the right way. And thus the king or the rulers The king or the ruler has to be himself a model of righteousness and virtue, and thereby inspire the people to follow his example. The king also has the duty to provide wealth to the poor, to make sure that everybody is economically secure. And also the king should learn from the wise, from monks, recluses, Brahmins, and sages. He should not be proud and arrogant because of his high position, but he should turn to sages for advice and guidance, especially to those monks who are distinguished by their learning, by their piety and wisdom. Thus, we see that during the golden age of Buddhism in South and Southeast Asia, the great Buddhist kings have always had a distinguished Mahatera, a senior member of the monastic order, as his special advisor to give him advice on and counsel on moral and religious matters. The last issue of the Buddha's political teaching that we will deal with is his approach to the problem of war. The Buddha teaches clearly and explicitly that to rule in accordance with Dhamma, the ruler, the government or king, has to avoid aggressiveness and attempts to conquer by violence. The Buddha himself once prevented a war between two states in the India of his time, the Koliyas and the Sakyas. These two lands were divided by a river, the River Rohini, and both wanted to divert the river for their own use. Because of this conflict over the use of the river, the two sides became hostile to one another, and they were prepared to go into battle, to fight, to take possession of the river. The armies were lined up on opposite sides of the river. And the Buddha learned about this. And both of these people were his own kinsmen. He himself was a Sakya, born in the Sakya land. His mother was a Koliya. And so the Buddha himself was related to people of both sides. When the Buddha learned about the impending conflict, he came onto the scene. He called the leaders into his presence, and then he asked them. He said, "Tell me, what is the value of the water in this river? Is it of very great value?" Both said, "No, the water is really of very little value." Then the Buddha said, "Tell me, what is the value of human blood?" They said, "Oh, the value of human blood is very great. Human blood is precious and priceless. Is precious and priceless." Then the Buddha asked, he said, "Tell me now, both of you, are you ready to shed all of this human blood to slaughter each other just for the sake of the water in this river? Is this a sensible thing to do?" When they were asked this, they said, "No, this is absolutely senseless." Thus they both gave up their weapons, they became friends, and they lived together in peace, sharing the use of the water in the river between them. Time and again the Buddha teaches in one way or another that violence must be avoided, that peace can never be established by force and conquest. The Buddha says that when one side conquers another, the conqueror only breeds resentment in the one who is defeated, while he himself has to live in constant anxiety, worrying that he will be defeated in turn. Neither side really wins the battle. The conqueror also loses, since he can never find happiness, never be free from worry and anxiety through his victory. Peace, the Buddha says, can only be found by stepping outside the vicious circle of conquest and violence. The real conqueror for the Buddha is not the man who conquers other men, other nations, and other societies, but the man who conquers himself. The Buddha said that if there is a warrior who conquers in battle 1,000 men 1,000 times, his conquest is very slight compared with the conquest of a man who conquers one man, namely himself. The man who conquers himself, his desires, cravings, anger, and delusions, He is the supreme victor in battle. And the Buddha teaches that there are four kinds of conquest that his followers should make. That is, they should conquer the evil person by means of goodness. They should conquer the liar by truth. They should conquer the stingy by giving generously. And they should conquer the hostile man by love and by goodness. For it is only by love, the Buddha teaches, never by hatred and violence, that hatred can be brought to cease. It is only by peace, by patience, by kindness and compassion, that the cycle of violence and revenge can be brought to a stop.